Tales from the Jazz Age by F. Scott Fitzgerald. The Diamond as Big as the Ritz. Chapter 2. The Montana sunset lay between two mountains like a gigantic bruise from which dark arteries spread themselves over a poisoned sky. An immense distance under the sky crouched the village of Fish, minute, dismal, and forgotten. There were 12 men, so it was said, in the village of Fish, 12 somber and inexplicable souls who sucked a lean milk from the almost literally bare rock upon which a mysterious populatory force had begotten them. They had become a race apart, these 12 men of Fish, like some species developed by an early whim of nature, which, on second thought, had abandoned them to struggle and extermination. Out of the blue-black bruise in the distance crept a long line of moving lights upon the desolation of the land, and the 12 men of Fish gathered like ghosts at the shanty depot to watch the passing of the 7 o'clock train, the Transcontinental Express from Chicago. 6 times or so a year, the Transcontinental Express, through some inconceivable jurisdiction, stopped at the village of Fish, and when this occurred, a figure or so would disembark, mount into a buggy that always appeared from out of the dusk, and drive off towards the bruised sunset. The observation of this pointless and preposterous phenomenon had become a sort of cult among the men of Fish. To observe, that was all. There remained in them none of the vital quality of illusion which would make them wonder or speculate, else a religion might have grown up around these mysterious visitations. But the men of Fish were beyond all religion. The barest and most savage tenets of even Christianity could gain no foothold on that barren rock. So there was no altar, no priest, no sacrifice. Only each night at 7, the silent concourse by the shanty depot, a congregation who lifted up a prayer of dim, anemic wonder. On this June night, the great brakeman whom, had they deified anyone, they might well have chosen as their celestial protagonist, had ordained that the 7 o'clock train should leave its human or inhuman deposit at Fish. At 2 minutes after 7, Percy Washington and John T. Unger disembarked, hurried past the spellbound, the agape, the fearsome eyes of the 12 men of Fish, mounted into a buggy which had obviously appeared from nowhere, and drove away. After half an hour, when the twilight had coagulated into dark, the silent Negro who was driving the buggy hailed an opaque body somewhere ahead of them in the gloom. In response to his cry, it turned upon them a luminous disk which regarded them like a malignant eye out of the unfathomable night. As they came closer, John saw that it was the taillight of an immense automobile, larger and more magnificent than any he had ever seen. Its body was of gleaming metal, richer than nickel and lighter than silver, and the hubs of the wheels were studded with iridescent geometric figures of green and yellow. John did not dare to guess whether they were glass or jewel. 2 Negroes, dressed in glittering livery, such as the one seen in pictures of royal processions in London, were standing at attention beside the car, and as the 2 young men dismounted from the buggy, they were greeted in some language which the guest could not understand, but which seemed to be an extreme form of the Southern Negro's dialect. "Get in," said Percy to his friend, as their trunks were tossed to the ebony roof of the limousine. "Sorry we had to bring you this far in that buggy, but of course it wouldn't do for the people on the train or those God-forsaken fellows in Fish to see this automobile." "Gosh, what a car!" This ejaculation was provoked by its interior. John saw that the upholstery consisted of 1,000 minute and exquisite tapestries of silk, woven with jewels and embroideries, and set upon a background of cloth of gold. The 2 armchair seats in which the boys luxuriated were covered with stuff that resembled duvetyn, but seemed woven in numberless colors of the ends of ostrich feathers. "What a car!" cried John again in amazement. "This thing?" Percy laughed. "Why, it's just an old junk we use for a station wagon." By this time they were gliding along through the darkness toward the break between the 2 mountains. "We'll be there in 1.5 hours, said Percy, looking at the clock. "I may as well tell you, it's not going to be like anything you ever saw before." Now, if the car was any indication of what John would see, he was prepared to be astonished indeed. The simple piety prevalent in Hades was the earnest worship of and respect for riches as the first article of its creed. Had John felt otherwise than radiantly humble before them, his parents would have turned away in horror at the blasphemy. They had now reached and were entering the break between the two mountains, and almost immediately the way became much rougher.
"If the moon shone down here, you'd see that we're in a big gulch," said Percy, trying to peer out of the window.
He spoke a few words into the mouthpiece, and immediately the footman turned on a searchlight and swept the hillsides with an immense beam.
"Rocky, you see? An ordinary car would be knocked to pieces in half an hour. In fact, it'd take a tank to navigate it unless you knew the way. You notice we're going uphill now."
They were obviously ascending, and within a few minutes the car was crossing a high-rise where they caught a glimpse of a pale moon newly risen in the distance. The car stopped suddenly, and several figures took shape out of the dark beside it. These were Negroes also. Again, the two young men were saluted in the same dimly recognizable dialect. Then the Negroes set to work, and four immense cables dangling from overhead were attached with hooks to the hubs of the great jeweled wheels. At a resounding "Hyah!", John felt the car being slowly lifted from the ground, up and up, clear of the tallest rocks on both sides, then higher, until he could see a wavy, moonlit valley stretched out before him in sharp contrast to the quagmire of rocks that they had just left. Only on one side was there still rock, and then suddenly there was no rock beside them or anywhere around. It was apparent that they had surmounted some immense knife blade of stone, projecting perpendicularly into the air. In a moment they were going down again, and finally, with a soft bump, they were landed upon the smooth earth.
"The worst is over," said Percy, squinting out the window. "It's only 5 miles from here, and our own road. Tapestry brick all the way. This belongs to us. This is where the United States ends, Father says."
"Are we in Canada?"
"Oh, no, we are not. We're in the middle of the Montana Rockies. But you are now on the only 5 square miles of land in the country that's never been surveyed."
"Why hasn't it? Did they forget it?"
"No," said Percy, grinning. "They tried to do it 3 times. The first time my grandfather corrupted a whole department of the state survey. The second time he had the official maps of the United States tinkered with. That held them for 15 years. The last time was harder. My father fixed it so that their compasses were in the strongest magnetic field ever artificially set up. He had a whole set of surveying instruments made with a slight defection that would allow for this territory not to appear, and he substituted them for the ones that were to be used. Then he had a river deflected, and he had what looked like a village up on its bank so that they'd see it and think it was a town 10 miles farther up the valley. There's only one thing my father's afraid of," he concluded. "Only one thing in the world that could be used to find us out."
"What's that?"
Percy sank his voice to a whisper.
"Aeroplanes," he breathed.
"We've got 6 anti-aircraft guns, and we've arranged it so far, but there's been a few deaths and a great many prisoners. Not that we mind, Father and I, but it upsets Mother and the girls, and there's always the chance that sometime we won't be able to arrange it."
Shreds and tatters of chinchilla courtesy clouds in the green moon's heaven were passing the green moon like precious eastern stuffs paraded for the inspection of some Tartar Khan. It seemed to John that it was day and that he was looking at some lads sailing above him in the air, showering down tracts and patent medicine circulars with their message of hope for despairing rock-bound hamlets. It seemed to him that he could see them look down out of the clouds and stare at whatever there was to stare at in this place whither he was bound. What then? Were they induced to land by some insidious device to be immured far from patent medicines and from tracts until the judgment day, or should they fail to fall into the trap? Did a quick puff of smoke and the sharp round of a splitting shell bring them drooping to earth and upset? Percy's mother and sisters? John shook his head, and the wraith of a hollow laugh issued silently from his parted lips. What desperate transaction lay hidden here? What a moral expedient of a bizarre croesus! What terrible and golden mystery! The chinchilla clouds had drifted past now, and outside the Montana night was bright as day. The tapestry brick of the road was smooth to the tread of the great tires as they rounded a still moonlit lake. They passed into darkness for a moment, a pine grove, pungent and cool. Then they came out into a broad avenue of lawn, and John's exclamation of pleasure was simultaneous with Percy's taciturn, "We're home." full in the light of the stars, an exquisite chateau rose from the borders of the lake, climbed in marble radiance half the height of an adjoining mountain, then melted in grace, in perfect symmetry, in translucent feminine languor into the mass darkness of a forest of pine. The many towers, the slender tracery of the sloping parapets, the chiseled wonder of a thousand yellow windows with their oblongs and hectagons and triangles of golden light, the shattered softness of the intersecting planes of starshine and blue shade, all trembled on John's spirit like a chord of music. On one of the towers, the tallest, the blackest at its base, an arrangement of exterior lights at the top made a sort of floating fairyland, and as John gazed up in warm enchantment, the fainter catch of Carrie's sound of violins drifted down in a rococo harmony that was like nothing he had ever heard before. Then, in a moment, the car stepped before wide, high marble steps, around which the night air was fragrant with a host of flowers. At the top of the steps, two great doors swung silently open, and amber light flooded out upon the darkness, silhouetting the figure of an exquisite lady with black, high-piled hair, who held out her arms toward them. "Mother," Percy was saying, "this is my friend, John Unger, from Hades." Afterward, John remembered that first night as a daze of many colors, of quick sensory impressions, of music soft as a voice in love, and of the beauty of things, lights, and shadows, and motions, and faces. There was a white-haired man who stood drinking a many-hued cordial from a crystal thimble set on a golden stem. There was a girl with a flowery face, dressed like Titania, with braided sapphires in her hair. There was a room where the solid, soft gold of the walls yielded to the pressure of his hand, and a room that was like a Platonic conception of the ultimate prison, ceiling, floor, and all. It was lined with an unbroken mass of diamonds, diamonds of every size and shape, until, lit with tall violet lamps in the corners, it dazzled the eyes with a whiteness that could be compared only with itself, beyond human wish or dream. Through a maze of these rooms the two boys wandered. Sometimes the floor under their feet would flame in brilliant patterns from lighting below, patterns of barbaric clashing colors of pastel delicacy, of sheer whiteness, or of subtle and intricate mosaic, surely from some mosque on the Adriatic Sea. Sometimes beneath layers of thick crystal he would see blue or green water swirling, inhabited by vivid fish and growths of rainbow foliage. Then they would be treading on furs of every texture and color or along corridors of palest ivory, unbroken as though carved complete from the gigantic tusks of dinosaurs extinct before the age of man. Then a hazily remembered transition, and they were at dinner, where each plate was of two almost imperceptible layers of solid diamond between which was curiously worked a filigree of emerald design, a shaven sliced from green air. Music, plangent and unobtrusive, drifted down through far corridors. His chair, feathered and curved insidiously to his back, seemed to engulf and overpower him as he drank his first glass of port. He tried drowsily to answer a question that had been asked him, but the honeyed luxury that clasped his body added to the illusion of sleep. Jewels, fabrics, wines, and metals blurred before his eyes into a sweet mist. "Yes," he replied with a polite effort, "it certainly is hard enough for me down there." He managed to add a ghostly laugh, then, without movement, without resistance, he seemed to float off and away, leaving an ice dessert that was pink as a dream. He fell asleep. When he awoke, he knew that several hours had passed. He was in a great quiet room with ebony walls and a dull illumination that was too faint, too subtle to be called a light. His young host was standing over him.
"You fell asleep at dinner," Percy was saying. "I nearly did, too. It was such a treat to be comfortable again after this year of school. Servants undressed and bathed you while you were sleeping."
"Is this a bed or a cloud?" sighed John.
Percy, before you go, I want to apologize."
"For what?"
"For doubting you when you said you had a diamond as big as the Ritz-Carlton Hotel."
Percy smiled.
"I thought you didn't believe me. It's that mountain, you know."
"What mountain?"
"The mountain the chateau rests on. It's not very big for a mountain, but except about 50 feet of sod and gravel on top, it's solid diamond. One diamond, 1 cubic mile, without a flaw. Aren't you listening? Say—"
But John T. Unger had again fallen asleep. the end of Chapter 2 of The Diamond as Big as the Ritz. As originally published in Tales from the Jazz Age by F. Scott Fitzgerald. Read by Rick Kistner for it to go on the web at fcit.usf.edu.